State governors aren't the only lawmakers expressing misgivings about the cost of restructuring health care. Joining us now for some analysis is NPR's Cokie Roberts. Good morning, Cokie.
Hi, Linda. Didn't that oysters and grits sound awfully good at that governor's breakfast?
Yes, it did. we've just heard the governor saying they want a health care overhaul, but they don't have the money. Yet, the Obama administration is still going full steam ahead, pushing the major health care bill. What's going on?
Well, the Obama administration is very eager, as you well know, to get this bill done. But members of Congress are getting increasingly nervous when the Congressional Budget Office Director Douglas Elmendorf said on Friday that it wouldn't save any money and as is, could add to the deficit over the next 10 years. That just sent everybody in the administration scrambling. Yesterday, the White House budget director, Peter Orszag, was on a couple of the Sunday TV shows. He said that the bill would be deficit neutral. He reiterated what the president had said on his Saturday radio address, that they would not sign on, the administration would not sign on to any bill that added to the deficit. And so they're out just trying to reassure both the public and the Congress. Senator Kennedy, from his sick bed, essentially, had a big essay in Newsweek magazine called The Cause of My Life, basically pleading for health care reform. But this is, as you well know, when it gets to actually writing the bills, this is where it gets very tough.
Now, all of this jockeying on health care has had an effect on the president's poll numbers. ABC News has a new survey out this morning that show his approval rating is down and support for his health care plan has fallen to 49%. Is that going to have an impact on what's going on in Congress?
Sure, of course it will. The health care plan that's dropped to 49%, it was described as like the one that the Democrats passed in the House of Representatives. So the Republican drumbeat against all of this is having an effect. The Republicans now might be overdoing it because they're calling this the president's Waterloo, saying that if they beat him here, it will cripple him for good. And Democrats don't want that to happen because, you know, if he gets weakened, they get weakened. So it might be that the drumbeat against it might be organizing the Democrats and motivating them to get something done. It certainly seems to be motivating the White House.
So what is the president going to do to convince the Congress and the rest of us to go
along? He's calling members in and listening, and also just reassuring them. And he's doing a very interesting thing, which is doing all kinds of separate deals with major stakeholders, the pharmaceutical industry, the hospital industry, doctors. I mean, the AMA is supporting health care reform, the American Medical Association. That's huge. I mean, I remember the Medicare fight where they were against it so strongly, and that made a tremendous difference. So having them on his side is big. He's going to have a primetime press conference on Wednesday night, and he's ginning up that formidable grassroots campaign that he identified during the presidential campaign of having 13 million people get engaged for health care reform.
Do you think they'll do it if his approval rating is down from 72 to 59? Do you think that indicates those 13 million may be harboring some doubt?
I think most of the fall off looks like it's among Republicans. A 16-point drop there. Democrats still really strongly support the president, 90%. But what you are seeing is more people calling themselves independent, and the president's having some problems there. His bigger problem is if he looks at a president in a similar position at this point in his first term, Ronald Reagan. As the economy weakened, so did his numbers. That hurt his party in the next election. This president wants to avoid that, and he thinks health care reform might be the way he does that.
Thanks very much. NPR's Cokie Roberts.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Madeline Brand in California.
And I'm Robert Siegel in Washington. Sunday witnessed one of the great events in the history of golf and in the history of 59. Tom Watson, came within a single putt of winning the British Open just a few weeks shy of his 60th birthday. Such things just do not happen. All over the world, men who used to play sports better, run faster, used to hit balls harder and hold a putter steadier, were with Watson in spirit, convinced that for 3 days and 17 holes of golf, the brilliance of past decades can somehow revisit us. What was it like to be there? Well, we are going to ask Neil Oxman, who has been Tom Watson's caddy since 2003, and joins us from the UK, where I guess Tom Watson's getting ready for the British Senior Open now.
We already played a practice round today, Robert.
What was it like being there through those 4 days when up until the last minute it looked like Watson was going to win another British Open?
Well, obviously it was very exciting because Tom is a real hero in Scotland. He's won 5 British Opens and 3 Senior British Opens. And most of them have been won in Scotland, and people there just love him. And so the crowd was quite excited, and they were screaming for him the whole time. And the atmosphere was obviously the only word really you can use is electric.
How many times have you relived the 18th hole of the 4th round in your head so far?
Well, I did not sleep last night. I ended up, instead of staying overnight in Scotland, I just decided to drive down through the night to London. And that's all I thought about. And, you know, in my real life, not that this isn't real life. I work in politics. And
we should explain that you're no stranger to NPR programs as a political consultant in Pennsylvania, but this is your other life. Okay.
Right. But, you know, we've literally, the campaign group, the company I work for, we've done 650 contested primary and general elections in 30 years. And, you know, I've dwelled on 3 or 4 races that I've lost over the years. You tend not to think about the ones you've won. You tend to think about those that got away. This is never going to leave me. If Tom had won, this would have clearly been one of the half dozen sort of most important things in the history of golf. And, you know, it was just sort of going to be what ifs forever. What happens if we had hit a 9-iron from the middle of the 18th fairway? There's just a million things that you think about that, you know, I'm going to, you know, just wish that it turned out differently.
Yeah, he shot an 8-iron from the 18th fairway. That's more yardage. It looked like it was going to stay on the green, but it just rolled over. It just went a little bit too long.
Yeah, Tom usually hits an 8-iron 145 yards, and we had 189 yards, and even though we've been hitting 7-iron, but just to make sure the ball stayed on the green, we hit an 8. And I told somebody today as a joke, the final words of my life will be, you know, I should have made Tom hit a 9-iron there, but, you know, and then dramatically go to sleep forever.
Now, one could say, after all was said and done, Tom Watson at 59 came in second in a British Open and made it to a playoff and was one putt away from winning. Historic, pretty amazing. But I guess if you play to win all your life, that's not how you think about it.
Obviously, that's a big deal. I mean, you know, if you had said to Watson, you're going to finish second next week at the British Open, he would have laughed and said, I'll take it. But under the circumstances, you get so close because you're leading with one hole to go. No, it is remarkable. I mean, it's really a thing. It just, you know, wish it had ended up being one shot lower and who knows?
So as things go, caddying for the 59-year-old champion at a British Open or, say, running a victorious presidential political campaign in the U.S.?
Robert, it is even close. I enjoy this much more than having to deal with the guys who have ruined the country.
Well, Neil Oxman, thank you very much for talking
with
us
today.
Neil Oxman, who, as he says, is a caddy. He caddies for Tom Watson, who came oh so close to winning the British Open yesterday. What the future holds may indeed, as President Obama said today, depend on what young people think about going to the moon and beyond. Nell Greenfield Boyce went out in Washington, D.C. to ask some young people.
Laura Fabens-Lassen is from Philadelphia. She's 20 years old, so she was born years after Apollo ended and astronauts stopped walking on the moon.
When you think of the moon and people walking on the moon, how does that seem to you?
I'm not really fazed by that. It doesn't seem particularly... It doesn't seem like a big ordeal to me.
If they had another moon landing and it was sort of on TV, would you be watching it?
Yeah, absolutely, I'd watch it. Definitely.
Someone her age only knows about moonwalking from movies and books, and she's got plenty of company.
Half the world's population has been born since we stopped going to the moon.
Roger Launius is a curator at the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum.
In the true sense of the term, it's history for them.
NASA has long-term plans to put people back on the moon and go on to Mars. But young adults have grown up with routine space shuttle flights and tragedies like Challenger and Columbia. One survey a few years ago suggested that they aren't that enthusiastic about a moon mission. If the younger generation isn't as interested, that could be a problem for NASA, because today's kids will be tomorrow's voting taxpayers.
I'm Tice Kamaniak, and I'm 7.
And do you have any thoughts about whether or not people should be going to the moon?
That'd be good, but I don't really know, like, if they should or shouldn't, because... Yeah.
Well, like, for example, would you personally be interested if given an opportunity to get off the planet?
Yeah, that would be interesting.
Other kids, like Abby Jones and Alina Church, are more gung-ho.
I think it'd be really fun to walk on the moon and search everything, all the planets and asteroid belts.
I think that NASA should be returning... My friends, well, some of them, they are interested in space, and I know I am, but I'm not sure about other people around me.
If I go to a classroom today, it's different than when I went when I was an astronaut in 1980.
Charles Bolden is President Obama's pick to be the next head of NASA.
I could ask, how many of you want to be an astronaut? And every hand went up in the class.
These days, he says, he'll see maybe 3 hands.
But we do have to reinvigorate the interest of youth in this country if we're going to do anything.
So NASA is tweeting and Facebooking and trying to catch the attention of teenagers like August Hagen, who is, you know, kind of open to the idea.
Are you into moon exploration? Is an astronaut a career that you would ever consider?
I don't think I would consider it, but I think it might be an interesting just thing to study.
Why wouldn't you consider it?
I sort of have a fear of heights.
Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
Who's in charge of the nation's largest school district, New York City's? You might assume the answer would be simple, but it isn't. This month, Mayor Michael Bloomberg lost control of the schools. A 7-year-old law had put him in charge, but the law expired in the midst of a leadership feud in the state Senate. Then, last week, lawmakers were on the verge of resolving the issue. Now, as Beth Fertig of member station WNYC reports, any hope of a solution has dissolved into name-calling.
Mayor Michael Bloomberg has never had a warm and fuzzy relationship with the state legislature, but when the state Senate went on summer recess without passing a bill to renew his control over the city schools, the situation got even chillier. On Friday, the mayor used his weekly radio show to urge Governor David Paterson to force the Senate back into session.
And he can send the state troopers to drag them back unless they're out of the state. And he should do that. And giving them a summer off is, as we say in Gaelic, mashugana.
As most New Yorkers know, mashugana is Yiddish for crazy. And observers would probably agree that New York politics has been just that lately. Before the Senate meltdown, renewing mayoral control was supposed to be a shoo-in because it's supported by Republicans and most Democrats. But now that the Senate's leadership crisis has been resolved, Democrats once again have a narrow majority. And some of them are furious with Bloomberg for urging them to pass a bill they claim doesn't include enough checks and balances to his control of the schools.
This is a battle that we've brought to the steps of City Hall. The mayor ultimately will have to compromise.
Brooklyn Senator Carl Krueger was among 10 senators who rallied outside City Hall yesterday. They made several references to Bloomberg's status as a billionaire, and they called him a dictator, a tyrant, and other things. Here's Harlem Senator Bill Perkins.
We are interested in negotiating and ending the plantation politics that apparently the mayor believes requires us to do his bidding without any other kind of negotiations.
The mayor has argued that Senate Democrats promised to vote on a bill to reauthorize mayoral control, but several senators opposed it because they wanted a bigger role for parents. Communities throughout the city have complained about feeling shut out of decisions, such as closing down schools and opening new ones. Sources say Bloomberg agreed to create a new parent training academy, but the senators claim he wouldn't put it in writing. The showdown comes while Mayor Bloomberg is running for a third term. New York voters have been getting regular mailings from his self-financed campaign boasting of higher test scores and words of praise from the U.S. Education Secretary. But Brooklyn Senator Eric Adams, a former police officer, says he and other Democrats won't back down from demanding changes to Bloomberg's school system.
If we didn't run from guys with big guns and crime, we're not running from guys with big wallets.
For now, the city schools are being run by a 7-member Board of Education, which was appointed after the law granting Bloomberg control expired on July 1st. The members immediately voted to keep Bloomberg's chancellor, Joel Klein, in charge of the system. But Bloomberg has warned that the lines of authority aren't so clear and that litigation is inevitable, which is why, unless the state Senate returns to Albany over the summer, by choice or by force, a resolution isn't expected before September. For NPR News, I'm Beth Fertig in New York.
Now, some advice on how the U.S. should deal with Iran from policy analyst David Makovsky. Makovsky and former Middle East negotiator Dennis Ross are the authors of Myths, Illusions, and Peace, Finding a New Direction for America in the Middle East. A big chunk of their book deals with Iran, and David Makovsky's co-author is now in the Obama administration helping to make policy on Iran and not available for author interviews. But David Makovsky, you are, and we're glad to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Robert.
You and Dennis Ross recommend what you call a hybrid approach to dealing with Iran, neither tighten the noose and hope for regime change, nor jump into talks without any preconditions at all. What is this hybrid approach? What's the virtue of it?
The hybrid approach is to say that the two other approaches often brought forward, one is by the neoconservative school that tends to view negotiations as a waste of time and believes the only thing that counts is regime change. The school identified called realism, which we don't always think is realistic, is a belief that deterrence always works. Like it worked in the Cold War, it doesn't matter if they have nuclear weapons, because just as the Soviets were deterred, so will the Iranians be deterred. We think there are some differences in this context between Iranian decision-making and Soviet decision-making. Some would say, well, of course it's different. You have a messianic leadership with Ahmadinejad and Khamenei. Others would say, no, they're not a messianist, but they're rational actors in the end. But even if you say that they're rational, there could be a lot of miscalculation.
So talk with the Iranians, become involved, you say, in diplomatic dealings with Iran to try to prevent them from developing nuclear weapons. Preconditions?
No. We think that the last administration tried preconditions, and we didn't think that was successful. Our belief, what we call the hybrid approach, is based on the idea that with Iran, we're giving them an unmistakable opportunity that if they want to join the international community, we're giving them the way to do so. At the same time, we are consulting with all our allies, with Russia and China, and saying to them, you wanted us to talk to Iran, we have to convey to Iran that there are clear economic and other consequences for failure.
So you guys be prepared to impose sanctions. We'll go in to talk. You, Germany, Britain, France, you be prepared to really back
at the right moment. You know, clearly you would ratchet up with failure. I mean, failure has very profound consequences for them.
One way that you describe that in the book is no preconditions for Iran, but preconditions for our European allies.
Exactly.
Relations with the U.S. and Iran have been so minimal in the past several years that I think it's a bit of an eye-opener for many people to realize that there have been landmark moments during this period of non-relations. One of them is the episode of the Iranian facts that you and Dennis Ross write about it. Describe what happened.
Well, it was right after the toppling of the statue, so to speak, of Saddam Hussein, and Iran feared it was going to be next. And through the Swiss ambassador, a fax was conveyed to the White House, which says that Iran is willing to talk, and about the agenda that the United States has wanted to talk about as well, not just the nuclear program, but support for Hezbollah, Hamas, etc. I think, unfortunately, the administration at the time didn't run with this and test it. We have no way of knowing.
They didn't answer it. They didn't respond.
Exactly. And some would say, well, it shows that Iran will respond to pressure because it was only because of the events of the time and the fear would be next that it did what it did. But I think this was a moment, there was a clear opening, and I think it was missed.
A foreign minister of an important U.S. Ally recently said to me and others, when asked whether Israel faced an existential threat from Iran having a nuclear arsenal, no, was his judgment. He said they don't, but if Iran had nuclear weapons, it would be a much more consequential rival in the region and would impose its will in many other places. Do you think that the Israelis are concerned that even though they have a nuclear arsenal of their own that they will not publicly discuss, that they live in fear of an Iranian missile with a nuclear warhead on it? Or do they live in fear of Gulf states and Emirates and the like being cowed by a stronger Iran?
I think it's all of them. You know, one Arab official said to me, look, we know the Israelis have a bomb, but they keep it in the basement. Our fear of Iran is if they get a bomb, they will wave it. And given the historic enmity between Iran and the Arabs, this is something that is of concern to them, and a belief that Iran with a nuclear weapon, as the president said, is a game changer because all these other states will want to have their own nuclear program.
Saudi Arabia would want a nuclear arsenal. Egypt wouldn't want the Saudis to be the only Arab state right. with a nuclear arsenal. And as you say, the Turks might then follow and also want to be a nuclear
Absolutely.
Power.
And you don't know how this will lead to proliferation to non-state actors. Will they export Iran a dirty bomb to its allies of Hezbollah and Hamas? So I do see it as a profound game changer. And as we try to point out in the book, it'll be a very different Middle East.
David Makovsky, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much for having me, Robert.
David Makovsky and Dennis Ross, who was not with us, are the authors of the new book, Myths, Illusions, and Peace, Finding a New Direction for America in the Middle East.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Linda Wertheimer. The nation's biggest banks, Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan Chase, Bank of America, and Citigroup, have reported profits for the second quarter. And while they may not yet be fat and happy, they're looking plump. To find out more, we turn to David Wessel. He is the economics editor of the Wall Street Journal. Good morning, David.
Good morning.
It's been less than a year since the worst moments of the financial crisis. Do these big profits mean the banks are all better?
I don't think so. What we've seen is the very strongest banks, Goldman, JP Morgan, are taking advantage of the weakness of some of their competitors, and their profits are zooming back. But the weaker ones, Bank of America, Citigroup, took some one-time only gains in the second quarter, stuff that they can't keep doing. They're still hobbled by bad loans. GE Capital, which is owned by General Electric, which we don't think of as a bank but is pretty close to one, said its profits were down 80%. And, of course, we see CIT, the business finance house, struggling to get some time from its lenders so it doesn't have to file for bankruptcy. So they're not out of the woods yet.
Are you telling me that these good quarterly results don't necessarily mean good news for the larger economy?
Well, it's good news for the larger economy if some of the banks are beginning to function more normally so they can begin lending. But when you look at the details of the bank's results, you see a number of them made a lot of money by trading and investment banking, but not by making old-fashioned loans and getting them paid back. The loan business is being hit very hard by the economy because high unemployment and other problems are making it hard for businesses and consumers, or many of them, to pay back their loans. Mm-hmm. So we saw, for instance, the CEO of Citigroup say that the rate of growth in consumer losses may be moderating, which was as close as he could come to being optimistic.
Are these banks and their shareholders profiting from the taxpayer help?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, first of all, if the entire financial system had collapsed, all of the banks, even the strong ones, would have been hurt. So some of the banks have paid back the money that the Treasury invested in them, particularly Goldman and J.P. Morgan, but they benefited handsomely from the federal rescue of the entire system, and they were able to sell bonds that were guaranteed by the government, which is pretty unusual. Some of the other banks, Bank of America and Citi, for instance, are still very much wards of the state. Between the two, they have $90 billion in taxpayer money. They're not out of trouble yet. And so the question is raised sort of, did the government get a good enough deal by dealing with these banks? And there's an argument about that.
If the banks, or some of them, are really making this kind of big money, do you think that they are going to wander back into the area of big salaries and mega bonuses?
Well, that's a good question. It was kind of surprising to me that we saw a couple of stories last week about big banks paying tons of money, Bank of America, Citigroup paying millions of dollars. But I think that I was surprised they did it. It's certainly bad PR, and it suggested an awful lot of confidence that they could keep making money in the future. But I think that as the finance sector shrinks, as we expect, as there are fewer big players, it's unlikely that we'll return to the bad old days when you were reading of so many people making lots of money. It's also going to cause an enormous political uproar if taxpayer-financed banks are able to pay $6, $7 million. And, of course, it's also going to fuel some of the stuff you hear in Congress about raising taxes on rich people, because if people read in the paper that these companies are making so much money and paying so handsomely, mm-hmm. people are going to ask, why shouldn't those people pay higher taxes?
David Wessel, economics editor for The Wall Street Journal, thanks very much.
You're welcome.